absolute power when it could have been his, and he voluntarily gave up power at war's end. Through all of this, he became the personification of the revolution and its values. Washington then lent his prestige to the Constitutional Convention, and by doing so, he helped to assure the ratification of that document, and he became our first president. As president, he established the nation's finances on a sound basis. He crushed a rebellion. He avoided war with England, and he secured the western frontier by both treaty and war. He made the new frame of government work, and in the process, he established countless precedents. The most important of these may well have been the two-term limit, where once again, he voluntarily renounced power and thus further solidified the American ideology of Republican liberty. As a private citizen, by the way, he also renounced slavery by including in his will a provision that his slaves be freed after his death and his wife's death. That was something that Thomas Jefferson, the great apostle of liberty, would not do. Washington's most important contributions were thus negative, and as such, they are easily forgotten, but they were vital to the success of this nation, and his reputation as the father of the country is fully warranted, though not for the reasons we think. Now, why have these negative contributions been so often ignored? Essentially because they were not only negative, but also because they were critical to what did not happen, a non-event, the creation of a dictatorship, military or otherwise. And it is very easy to overlook and ignore an event that prevented something from happening. Yet such a negative consequence is often at least as important in history as positive consequences. Try to remember that as we proceed through this course.
Lecture 5, Confusions About Jefferson and Hamilton.
During the 1790s, Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton held sharply conflicting views as to the proper domestic and foreign policies for the new nation and as to how the new Constitution should be interpreted. Today, many label Hamilton's views as conservative and Jefferson's as liberal, and they see their conflict as a harbinger of contemporary conflicts. Yet the specific issues over which Hamilton and Jefferson argued are in no way related or relevant to contemporary issues. And their views have little, if anything, to do with the terms conservative and liberal as they are presently defined. To believe that they do is a classic example of anachronistic thinking, of projecting contemporary values and meanings of words onto a past where they do not fit. Now, more accurate might be the term aristocratic for Hamilton and democratic for Jefferson, but even here, the terms distort the historical reality more than they enlighten. Nevertheless, the conflicting views of Hamilton and Jefferson are deeply relevant to us today, but not in the ways we normally think of them. We first need to recognize, as was stated in the last lecture, that Washington had selected Jefferson and Hamilton for the two most important cabinet positions as part of his general effort to maintain sectional balance, not political, ideological balance, within the new national government. This desire for sectional balance is one reason why John Adams of Massachusetts was chosen as vice president to balance Washington of Virginia as president. Now, Washington was trying to create geographic balance within his cabinet by selecting Hamilton from New York City as the Secretary of the Treasury and Jefferson from Virginia as Secretary of State. None of them had any idea of the split that would develop. That split developed primarily over two issues of no relevance to us today, but of great relevance to them. One domestic and one foreign. Government fiscal policies and definitions of neutrality when England and France went to war once again in 1793. Hamilton, as the Treasury Secretary, believed the most pressing problems of the United States were financial. That we needed to establish our credit, both at home and abroad, if the new government was to work. He therefore proposed that the new national government assume all state Revolutionary War debts, combine them with the national debt, and fund both debts at par value via a new bond issue. He also proposed new taxes on imports and some domestically produced items in order to pay these debts, and the establishment of a combined private and government-controlled national bank, 80% private, 20% government, to serve as a depository for Treasury notes and a fiscal agent for the government. The bank's notes were to be considered legal tender. Now, all of this, Hamilton proposed, would tie the wealthy merchant and financial class to the success of the new government while providing a new circulating medium. It would also establish the credit of the new government and increase its power and prestige. The crack that is usually made is that Hamilton was going to turn the national debt into a national blessing. Now, opposition to his plan was at first led not by Jefferson, but by James Madison, with whom Hamilton had collaborated in writing the Federalist Papers. Jefferson at first served as a mediator between the two. He arranged a stag dinner during which Madison agreed to support funding and assumption in return for Hamilton's agreement that the permanent capital, at this time the temporary capital was New York City, that the permanent capital would be in the South on land that Virginia and Maryland would eventually donate on the Potomac River. But after this mediation, Jefferson, in the cabinet, opposed Hamilton's proposed national bank, which had not been part of the deal. National bank was proposed later. Jefferson opposed it on the grounds that since establishing a national bank was not a specifically enumerated national power within Article 1 of the Constitution, to establish such a bank would be unconstitutional. Hamilton countered that it was constitutional via the necessary and proper clause in Article 1, Section 8, that Congress had the power, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the specific powers previously listed. In this case, the powers to pay debts, borrow money, and coin money. Washington sided with Hamilton on this issue, but a serious split had emerged. Nevertheless, it was only at the highest levels of government, and Washington was unanimously reelected president in 1792. The split over foreign affairs emerged in the following year, 1793, when the French Revolution turned radical with the creation of the French Republic, the execution of the king, and the institution of the Reign of Terror. This resulted in the outbreak of a general war in Europe, pitting Republican France against Britain and all the other major monarchies of Europe. Now, everyone in Washington's cabinet agreed that the United States should remain neutral in this war. But the United States still had a treaty of alliance with France dating back to the Revolutionary War. What were you going to do with it? The question also arose as to neutrality favoring whom? Hamilton argued for neutrality favoring Britain. Jefferson argued for neutrality favoring the sister republic of France. Now, as explained in the last lecture, Washington at first took a middle-of-the-road position, agreeing with Hamilton and against Jefferson's advice to immediately issue a neutrality proclamation, but agreeing with Jefferson and against Hamilton's advice to recognize the new French Republic and accept its new minister to the United States, Edmond Genet. But by 1794-95, Washington was siding with Hamilton more and more. Most importantly, by agreeing to the odious Jay Treaty with England. Now, that treaty avoided war with England, which is why Washington agreed to it. But he had to accede to the British definition of neutral rights in return for British evacuation of posts on U.S. territory in the old Northwest. When that treaty became public, it led to an uproar against it and to the formation of the first two national political parties, the Federalists under Hamilton and the Democratic Republicans under Jefferson and Madison. In the presidential election of 1796, the Federalist John Adams, the vice president at that point, narrowly defeated his old friend Thomas Jefferson for the presidency. But Jefferson had the second highest number of electoral votes. Remember, the writers of the Constitution had not imagined permanent political parties. The way they had set the system up, the person with the majority of electoral votes, the highest number of electoral votes, would become president. The second highest would become vice president. As a result, you had president from one party, vice president from another party. The 12th Amendment of 1804 would separate the electoral vote for president and for vice president. But obviously that amendment was not in effect in 1796. Now, during Adams' presidency, the dispute between the two political parties became white hot as the United States engaged in an undeclared naval war with France as a result of the Jay Treaty. And the two parties, the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, came very close to civil war. The Federalists in Congress would pass the Alien and the Sedition Acts, which violated civil liberties and were directed against the Democratic Republicans. Jefferson and Madison would respond with the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, threatening nullification of these laws and any others that violated their civil rights. Now, these specific issues are of little or no relevance to us today. Both domestically and internationally, they are issues for a young and weak nation, which is exactly what we were at that time vis-a-vis Britain and France, who were the two superpowers of the era. But many argue that the conflicting beliefs behind the specific issues are relevant to us today. They are, but not in the ways you may think. Most obviously relevant are Jefferson's and Hamilton's conflicting interpretations of the Constitution. Jefferson argued for a narrow interpretation of national power versus state power, i.e., the national bank was unconstitutional because no such power to establish one was in the Constitution. Hamilton countered with a broad interpretation via the Necessary and Proper Clause. This argument over state versus national power is a constant in U.S. history right down to this very day. It pitted Federalists against Democratic Republicans throughout this era. Then it pitted Democrats against Whigs during the 1830s and 40s, and then Democrats against Republicans. But in this case, the positions in the 1790s are reversed from what they will later be and still are today, with the supposedly aristocratic Hamilton arguing for more national power and the supposedly democratic Jefferson arguing for less. Since the 1930s, Jefferson's liberal disciples, in fact, maybe earlier than 1930s, Jefferson's liberal disciples have argued for more national power and their conservative opponents for less. To further complicate matters, after Jefferson became president in 1801, he actually expanded national power, especially executive power, as do many of his successors, who campaigned against expanded power, but nevertheless did expand power. So while this issue is relevant to us today, obviously, the 18th century hero that each side looks to today actually held the opposite position from the one his supposed followers hold today. Now, others see relevance today in Jefferson's welcoming of the French Revolution. While Hamilton and his followers abhorred the French Revolution and thus favored the British. That's also true. But Hamilton had favored the British even before the French Revolution became radical, because British trade was essential to his domestic program. Most American imports came from Britain, and in Hamilton's system, import taxes would provide the bulk of the revenue for the federal government. British credit and manufactured goods were also essential for Hamilton's vision of American economic development. Jefferson's opposition to all this was based not so much on any love of Republican France, but on the fact that he did not support the Hamiltonian domestic program, and thus did not believe that the United States needed British trade or credit. He also feared dependency on the powerful British and desired to use the French connection as a counterweight. In other words, to pit Britain and France against each other in order to preserve American independence from the clutches of both. Let me cite for you in this regard what the French minister to the United States wrote home at one point. "Mr. Jefferson loves us," he wrote, "because he detests England. He seeks rapprochement with us because he distrusts us less than Great Britain. But he would change perhaps tomorrow from a sentiment favorable to us if tomorrow Great Britain should cease to inspire him with fears. Although Jefferson is the friend of liberty and science, although he is an admirer of the efforts we have made to cast off our shackles and to clear away the cloud of ignorance which weighs down the human race, Jefferson, I say, is an American. And as such, he cannot sincerely be our friend. An American is the born enemy of all the peoples of Europe." So while the supposedly democratic Jefferson did support the French Revolution, and the aristocratic Hamilton did oppose it and favor monarchical Britain, both men did so for political reasons having little to do with their feelings regarding any revolutionary ideology. Furthermore, and more importantly, in many ways, Hamilton is not really aristocratic, and Jefferson is not really democratic. Both men are Republicans. They do believe strongly in republicanism as opposed to monarchy. The question will be, what kind of republicanism? Republicanism simply means representative government, which the founders equated with liberty. But who will be the representatives, and who will they represent? Now, despite his reputation, Thomas Jefferson was not a Democrat who believed simply in majority rule. He and many of his peers considered this mob rule, which is what they equated with democracy. Remember Madison's comments in Federalist Number 10? Jefferson, like Madison, is a Virginia slave owner and an aristocrat who believes in property qualifications for voting, the stake in society theory. You must have a stake in society in order to participate in government. Jefferson also saw a decentralized agrarian society of self-sufficient, independent, or yeoman farmers as the best way to preserve liberty. And he believed in the politics of deference, whereby farmers would be allowed to vote because they had property, but they were to vote for their betters, their economic and their social betters. This was a general belief system in the United States in the late 18th century, and hardly a democratic notion by our standards. Hamilton, on the other hand, is no aristocrat. He's an illegitimate child from the West Indies. And he believes centralized power is necessary to preserve liberty from both internal chaos and external threat. Hamilton also believes that self-interest rules human nature, and that self-interest should be used to create such centralized power by linking the wealthy commercial and financial interests of the country to the interests of the national government. Jefferson, on the other hand, sees self-interest as an evil. Now, as you can see, the specific issues facing Jefferson and Hamilton and their ensuing disagreements have little to do with the issues we as a nation now have. Both men have aristocratic as opposed to democratic views by contemporary standards. Yet their disagreement is still relevant to us on multiple levels, albeit not as we think. First and foremost, as previously noted, is their disagreement over the interpretation of the Constitution and national versus state power. That disagreement will be a constant throughout U.S. history right down to the present day. But here, it is Hamilton's view that contemporary liberals embrace and Jefferson's view that contemporary conservatives embrace. Secondly, Jefferson's agrarianism and aristocratic emphasis on property qualifications for voting possess a strong democratic streak, not in our contemporary and urban world, but in the agrarian American world of the 1790s. At that time, the United States was overwhelmingly composed of farmers who owned their own land and who thus possessed sufficient property to vote. Yet for the future, Hamilton's commercial, manufacturing, and urban vision possesses an unwitting democratic streak in the opportunities for advancement that this would provide in the future. Beyond that, however, is the continued relevance of their conflicting views on human nature and the role of self-interest. Hamilton has a very pessimistic view of human nature. He sees humans as motivated by self-interest, and he seeks to harness that by tying the wealthy and the powerful to the new government so that there will be dependence on each other. The government will depend on these upper classes. They will depend on the government. Jefferson is the opposite. He sees self-interest and dependence as leading to corruption and the destruction of liberty. That's one of the reasons he is so anti-urban and so agrarian. He also believes strongly in Republican virtue and political disinterestedness of those in office and seeking office, rather than self-interest as appropriate for politics in a Republican society and as the key to preserving liberty. Now, while Jefferson's words will resonate with our democratic beliefs today, it is Hamilton's vision and views regarding a politics based on self-interest that will become our reality. The old concept of Republican virtue as central to politics, that concept which dominated the late 18th century political world, would disappear with the death of the founders and their replacement in the early 19th century by a new generation of political leaders with very different ideas. And ironically, that new view of politics would help to get Jefferson elected president in 1800 by his alliance with Aaron Burr and Burr's early New York City political machine, Tammany Hall. In a further irony, this is the same Aaron Burr who, as vice president, will kill Alexander Hamilton in a duel in 1804, and whose civil liberties Jefferson will then violate after Burr's conspiracy to create a private empire in the Southwest is uncovered. That sounds complicated, and it is. Let me explain. Remember, the 12th Amendment did not come into existence until 1804, so that each elector casts his votes, and the person with the highest number of votes becomes president, and the second highest becomes vice president. But because of party discipline in 1800, every Democratic-Republican elector cast one vote for Jefferson and one vote for Burr. So they are tied for the presidency. In that situation, the election goes to the House, where the Federalists are in the majority, and they will decide who will be the next president. There is a general feeling amongst many Federalists that they can work with Burr. They've come to believe their own propaganda about Jefferson is virtually the Antichrist, whereas Burr, they believe, is someone you can work with. Hamilton disagrees. He understands who Jefferson is. He believes that Burr is a total scoundrel. And he convinces many Federalists to vote for Jefferson rather than Burr. Now, in that situation, Burr realizes that he is going to be a one-term vice president. No way Jefferson is going to run with him in 1804. So he has to rebuild his political career. He decides to do so by running for the governorship in New York. That, too, is foiled by Hamilton, who denounces Burr, insults him, and that leads Burr to challenge Hamilton to duel. Dueling is illegal in New York. They row across the Hudson River to New Jersey to have the duel, and Burr kills Hamilton. He is still the vice president of the United States, and he is a fugitive from justice. What he now attempts to do with former Revolutionary War General James Wilkinson is to carve out a private empire in the Old Southwest. The plot is eventually discovered. Jefferson, in a panic, violates Burr's civil liberties on multiple occasions. In an attempt to get him jailed, he orders him arrested. He judges him guilty before there is any evidence. He throws the book at Burr, and he fails. Chief Justice John Marshall presides at the case, and Burr is set free. Now, Burr's killing of Hamilton does not result in the immediate demise of the Federalist Party. But it does leave that party leaderless. It also leaves it more and more geographically isolated in New England. Western expansion, both into territory up to the Mississippi River and into the Louisiana Purchase territory that Jefferson had obtained from France in 1803, brings in more and more supporters of Jefferson's Democratic Republicans. The Federalists had always been strongest in New England. More and more, it is becoming a regional party only. Now, Jefferson and his successor, James Madison, also pursue a policy of wooing moderate Federalists into their party, and they succeed. Even John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, joins the Democratic Republican Party. The way Jefferson and Madison do this is to agree to some Federalist concepts, including by 1816, a protective tariff for infant American industry, and the chartering of a second national bank in 1816, as well as a general expansion of federal power, including executive power. Please note in this regard, the expansion of national and executive power, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the president or the national government has the power to acquire territory. The Louisiana Purchase results from a Hamiltonian interpretation of the Constitution. Now, during the War of 1812, those still in the Federalist Party further isolate themselves by opposing the war, and at the Hartford Convention, they hypocritically call for states' rights and virtually threaten secession from the Union. News of the American military victories at Baltimore, Plattsburgh Bay, and New Orleans, and the negotiation of a peace treaty ending the war with Britain lead to the party's disgrace and collapse. In the election of 1820, the Democratic-Republican candidate James Monroe runs unopposed, and the nation enters an era of one-party rule, the misnamed era of good feelings. There were plenty of bad feelings. You had an economic depression, you had the Missouri crisis, but during this era, the Democratic-Republican Party encompasses the views of both Hamilton and Jefferson. But given the crises that take place, one-party rule could not and would not continue. And the Hamilton-Jefferson disagreements were so basic that they would soon reassert themselves in the creation of the so-called second two-party political system during the 1820s and the 1830s. It is to that new political system and the individual for whom it is named, Andrew Jackson, that we now turn our attention.
Lecture 6, Andrew Jackson, an Odd Symbol of Democracy.
The election of Andrew Jackson to the presidency in 1828 ushered in a new era in American history, one named after him, the Age of Jackson. It's also known as the Age of the Common Man, the era in which property qualifications for voting disappeared and the nation truly became democratic, well, at least in regard to the vote for all adult white males. Jackson became the symbol of this democratic thrust, the man of the people, elected in 1828 and reelected in 1832 by large majorities, with the people virtually taking over the White House for a wild party on the day he was inaugurated for his first term in 1829. We'll be talking more about that later. Yet Jackson was in many ways a very odd symbol of democratic reform. He himself was anything but a common man. In reality, he was a wealthy, slave-owning Tennessee planter and aristocrat. Furthermore, many of the policies he championed would not be considered democratic today. And he opposed most of the major democratic reform movements of his era, most notably abolitionism and rights for women, blacks, and Native Americans. Indeed, the conditions of these people deteriorated during the Age of Jackson. Jackson also supported some very undemocratic behavior. He backed Southern postmasters who had violated federal law by refusing to distribute abolitionist literature within the South. And he also supported the gag rule to prevent even the reading of abolitionist petitions that had been submitted to Congress. Yet simultaneously, Jackson was a very apt symbol for this democratic era. And careful examination reveals much about the nature of American democracy, both then and today. Let's look at Jackson's background first. He had been born into poverty and travail on the Carolina frontier in 1767. His father died 3 weeks before he was born. Both of his brothers and his mother died during the Revolutionary War. He was left an orphan at age 14. He was largely self-educated. He moved west where he prospered. He became a major slaveholding planter as well as a major political figure in the new state of Tennessee. During the War of 1812, he became a national military hero for his victory over the Creek Indians at the 1814 Battle of Horseshoe Bend and, of course, for his stupendous victory over the British in the 1815 Battle of New Orleans. He achieved further military fame for his famous 1818 invasion and conquest of Spanish Florida while pursuing Indians and escaped slaves. That eventually led to the acquisition of Florida by a treaty with Spain. Now, throughout these years, Jackson also prospered economically. He made a fortune, he lost it, and he made another one. And in doing so, he became a symbol of the common man. The poor Westerner who went from rags to riches, then to rags again, and then to riches again. He was an aristocrat, but he was a self-made aristocrat. As well, he became a symbol of his era and its values. One historian, John William Ward, has noted that he became known as a man of nature, the man of providence, and the man of will, consistently overcoming adversity and impossible odds through an understanding of the natural order and the possession of both divine protection and incredible willpower. Let me give you four examples of this. First, how Jackson stopped army desertions in the War of 1812. While campaigning, his army at one point decided to, many in his army decided to go home. As they were walking down the road, they saw in the middle of the road, Jackson on horseback with a brace of pistols, one in each hand. Now, you had a very large number of men. Clearly, they could overcome one man. But Jackson made crystal clear that he would shoot and kill the first two men to try to cross the line. Nobody did. They turned around. Secondly, his putting together of a ragtag force of farmers and backwoods militia from Tennessee and Kentucky, along with French-speaking Louisiana militia, Mississippi dragoons, we would call cavalry, pirates from the island of Barataria, Irish regiments, black regiments, and Indian allies to defeat the finest army in the world at New Orleans. It wasn't a battle. It was a massacre. He inflicted 2,000 casualties approximately on that army while suffering only 21 himself. A third example. Ignoring diplomatic protocol and international law, Jackson invaded Spanish Florida in 1818 in pursuit of hostile Indians and escaped slaves who had crossed the border. In the process, he took two Spanish forts, executed two British subjects whom he found, deposed the Spanish governor at Pensacola, and later asserted that he regretted not hanging him, seized the Spanish archives, and appointed his own governor. Fourth and final example, Jackson's behavior and survival in a fierce duel in 1806 with a man known as a superb and proud marksman, one Charles Dickinson. Jackson came to the duel wearing a big cloak to mask his body size so that Dickinson could not tell where Jackson's body stopped and where the cloak started. Jackson then insisted that his opponent fire first. He did. The bullet lodged in his chest near his heart. Jackson pretended he was not hit. He wanted to make Dickinson think he had missed. Then Jackson carefully fired a mortal shot and left the field without flinching so that his opponent would die thinking he had missed. Ultimate macho, if you will. But all of Jackson's success was tempered by personal tragedy. That only enhanced his appeal as a man of the people who suffered as they did. The death of both parents and his brothers when he was very young. The winning and losing of a fortune and the death of his beloved wife, Rachel, just a few months before his presidential inauguration, perhaps as a result of the scandal regarding their marriage. That needs some explanation. Rachel had been divorced by her husband and had married Jackson in 1791, or so they thought. It turned out that what had occurred in 1791 was not a divorce, but only the granting of a decree authorizing her first husband to sue for divorce. No divorce actually took place until 1793. The marriage to Jackson was thus not legal, and a second marriage took place in 1794. Now, this issue would emerge in the 1828 presidential campaign with charges of adultery that Jackson believed caused Rachel's death at the end of the year. Jackson emerged as a major political figure in 1823 with his election to the Senate and in the 1824 presidential election. Now, you remember, 1824, we are still in the so-called era of good feelings. The Federalist Party had disappeared. There was only one national party, the Democratic-Republican Party, which had moved ideologically to the center as it became all-inclusive. But the party split in 1824 over its presidential candidate. The traditional method of nominating a candidate was the party caucus. And the caucus nominated Secretary of the Treasury William Crawford of Georgia. But others refused to accept this because the caucus was under attack as undemocratic. Three other candidates thus emerged to create a four-way race: John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, and Andrew Jackson. Let me talk a little bit about each of them. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts, the son of John Adams, a brilliant diplomat. He had helped to negotiate the peace treaty ending the War of 1812. He had served as minister to Great Britain and had then become one of the greatest of all American secretaries of state under President James Monroe. He was responsible for the acquisition of Florida. He was responsible for the Monroe Doctrine. And he was extremely puritanical. More on him in a later lecture. Next, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky, nickname Harry of the West, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, a war hawk during the War of 1812, also a peace negotiator at the end of the war, and now a senator from Kentucky, the popular voice of the West. Heavy drinker, heavy gambler. Once a woman said to his wife that it was terrible that he gambled so much. His wife laconically replied, "Oh, I don't know. He usually wins." During the peace negotiations at Ghent, Adams recorded in his diary that as he was getting up in the early morning to say his prayers, Clay was coming in from an all-night card game. There was another candidate at first, Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, also a war hawk and a nationalist at this time, but an individual who would soon move to states' rights in order to defend Southern slavery. Calhoun had the reputation of having a mind like a steel trap, the ultimate logician. The apocryphal story that is told is that once he broke down and wrote a love poem to his wife. But it was a love poem in which each verse began "whereas," except the last verse, which began "therefore." Calhoun dropped out of the race early on to run for the vice presidential position, which he won. The fourth candidate was thus Andrew Jackson of Tennessee, who ran as a war hero and an alternative voice to Clay of the New West. Now, when the votes were counted, Jackson had won a plurality of both the popular and the electoral vote, but no majority. So by the Constitution, the election went to the House of Representatives, where each state would cast one vote. Clay had the lowest number of votes. He's out. Crawford had suffered a serious stroke. So really, the contest boiled down to a choice between Adams and Jackson. Clay told his supporters to vote for Adams, whereupon Adams won with the votes of 13 out of 24 states. Soon thereafter, he appointed Henry Clay Secretary of State. That was the position seen at that time as the key stepping stone to the presidency. Cries quickly erupted of corrupt bargain. It was not a corrupt bargain, but it poisoned and doomed Adams' presidency. Jackson began running for president in the 1828 election virtually the next day, and he wound up in 1828 defeating Adams with 56% of the popular vote and a victory of 178-83 in the Electoral College. His ensuing inauguration was a wild affair, as people came from over 500 miles away and took over the White House during the inaugural party. Jackson himself was forced to leave to avoid being crushed. And in the words of historian George Dangerfield, people use satin-covered chairs as footstools, tapestries as throwaway napkins, and windows as doors. Now, many, if not most, historians agree that democracy made Jackson rather than Jackson making democracy. In fact, no one really understood what Jackson stood for in 1829. But as president, he would dominate events and would help to define the main political characteristics of this new democracy that had elected him. The key events of his presidency would be the removal of Indians east of the Mississippi River, the Maysville Road veto, the nullification crisis, and the destruction of the Second National Bank. Very briefly on each of these. Congress in 1830 had given Jackson the money and the authority to get all Indians east of the Mississippi to move west of the river, basically to Oklahoma. But Georgia decided to act on its own to remove the so-called five civilized tribes. The Cherokees, who were an agrarian people, who had a written language, and who had a constitution, as well as slaves. The Cherokees refused to move, and with their white friends and supporters, they took their case to the Supreme Court, which ruled in two cases, Cherokee Nation versus Georgia and Worcester versus Georgia, that they could not bring suit but as a domestic dependent nation. To use Chief Justice John Marshall's words, they were entitled to federal protection from any Georgia state action. Jackson simply refused to enforce this ruling, famously stating that Chief Justice John Marshall had made his decision and he could enforce it himself. Instead, Jackson let Georgia do what it wanted to do with the Cherokees and used federal forces to encourage their movement. The result would be the notorious Trail of Tears. In the Maysville Road veto, Jackson vetoed a bill that would have authorized federal funds for internal improvements. He insisted that this was a state issue and that the bill overstepped the powers granted to Congress. The nullification crisis, Jackson clearly supported slavery and the gag rule against the abolitionists. He also supported the actions of the South Carolina postmaster who barred abolitionist literature from the mails. But Jackson was an intense nationalist who would not tolerate South Carolina's attempt to nullify a new tariff law. Jackson also destroyed the Second National Bank of the United States. He did so by vetoing a new charter for the bank and removing federal funds before the old charter expired. He then moved those funds into state banks, pet banks. I'll talk about that more later in this lecture. Now, during these and other events, Jackson transformed the office of the presidency in the name of the people. How? First, massive use of the presidential veto. 12, including the first use of the pocket veto. All previous presidents together had only vetoed 9 bills. He also expanded executive power at the expense of Congress, refused, as was pointed out, to enforce Supreme Court decisions with which he disagreed, and became known to his enemies as King Andrew. Jackson justified this obvious expansion of presidential power on the grounds that he was the only government official elected by all the people, and that he was using this new power to tear down special privilege that had come to dominate Washington. In other words, stop Congress from acting beyond the Constitution via the Maysville Road Bill. Jackson, as you see, has a narrow interpretation of the Constitution. He will also act to tear down engines of special privilege when Congress would not act via the bank veto, and to block the courts when they did not act in the interests of the people. Jackson also instituted rotation in office and the spoil system for federal appointees. He justifies these as democratic moves on the entrenched aristocracy of educated bureaucrats. Education was at this time a luxury of the rich. And since theoretically anyone in a democratic society was theoretically qualified to hold government office. The best way to choose those who would actually hold office was to reward the party faithful, especially since politics itself was now viewed as a business run by self-interest and reward. This a major shift from the founding fathers and their concept of civic virtue. Jackson also instituted the kitchen cabinet of special personal advisors not subject to Senate confirmation. He justified this as a move away from the elitism of the established cabinet and necessary given the presence of political appointees in the cabinet whom he did not trust. Now, all these moves Jackson justified in the name of democracy. But today it is clear that many were not democratic and that they resulted in corruption of the American political system, as well as a dangerous expansion and abuse of executive power, a crippling of the American financial system, a gross denial of rights for opponents of slavery and for Indians. And by the way, with that denial of rights for Indians, immense profits for land speculators rather than the common people. Now, interestingly, many of Jackson's revolutionary moves were justified via the old Jeffersonian doctrine of limited government and states' rights, as well as democracy. Why? Well, there's a psychological point. In an era of drastic change, people will look to a past idea for reassurance. The old concept of Janus-faced, of facing in two opposite directions, of walking backwards into the future. Also, the Jacksonian coalition was made up of contradictory elements. All of them wanted change and were dissatisfied with the way things are, but they otherwise had very little in common. The lowest common denominator able to hold them together was a strict interpretation of the Constitution. This fact, as well as the contradictions in Jacksonian democracy, are best illustrated via an analysis of the so-called Bank War, the destruction of the Second National Bank of the United States. Chartered in 1816 for 20 years, that bank stood as a symbol of the Democratic Republican Party's move to the political center. Jefferson, you remember, had opposed the first bank. It was 20% government controlled, 80% private, and it served many useful functions, both for the government and for the American financial and economic systems as a whole. But it also had many enemies. There was general distrust of the bank from the Panic of 1819. The bank had called in its loans, seeing that the panic was coming, and this was viewed as a cause of the ensuing depression rather than a consequence of it. That reinforced the dislike of the bank by small farmers and eastern workers who wanted only what was known as hard money, money backed by gold and silver. They wanted this because they wanted to stop rising prices, and they thus opposed the bank's paper money, which was legal tender. But it didn't end there. The bank was also opposed by businessmen and Western bankers who wanted more paper money for easier loans. The National Bank prevented this by its power to call in notes if local banks had unsound banking practices. The bank was also opposed by financiers on Wall Street in New York City who wanted to emerge from the shadow of the super bank in Philadelphia that had federal support. It was also opposed by Southern slave owners who feared it as a dangerous precedent for federal power, as well as an institution that built up the power of the Northeast. And finally, it was opposed by old Jeffersonian Republicans who repeated Jefferson's argument that such a bank was unconstitutional. Now, the lowest common denominator here, which Jackson used to justify his veto of the bank recharter bill in 1832, was strict interpretation of the Constitution in order to destroy special privilege. But this is also an argument against any government control of the economy, and thus part of the new economic ideology of laissez-faire from Adam Smith. Smith had enunciated his ideas in 1776, and they had been gaining public acceptance as the United States began to industrialize. What Smith argued was an end to government control over the economy, something that was dominant in the mercantilist system, to revert instead to the laws of supply and demand, to let the invisible hand of the marketplace run things, let business run free. We will get back to that in a later lecture. Now, Jackson followed up on his veto of the bank bill after he was reelected in 1832 with a personal vendetta to destroy the bank, even though its charter still had 3 years to run. The bank, he asserted, was trying to destroy him, but he would destroy it to remove all government, by removing all government deposits. To do so, he had to fire two Treasury secretaries who feared financial and economic disaster if this was done. He finally found a third, Roger Taney, willing to do this. Disaster did follow. Jackson placed federal funds in certain state banks known as PEP banks, which then used such funds to underwrite more paper money. That led to inflation and massive overspeculation in land and a vicious cycle. Speculators would borrow bad paper money, give it to the government for land, and the government would give it back to the PEP banks, who would then issue more loans. Jackson tried to stop this in 1836 with his specie circular, which announced that henceforth the government would accept only gold and silver for land. The land market, which was a bubble, thereupon collapsed. Overextended banks called in their loans. That led to panic and depression in 1837 under Jackson's successor, Martin Van Buren. So what can we conclude from this? Jackson was an apt symbol for the Democratic era in which all free white males obtained the right to vote. He was also an apt symbol for the ideological revolution in economics, as laissez-faire triumphed over government direction of economic growth. And these two, political and economic, were now fused in American ideology by the concept of equality of opportunity, and thus no special favors from government for anyone. Jackson further helped to ensconce laissez-faire and equality of opportunity as major features of American ideology and economic history by appointing Roger Taney, his third Treasury Secretary, who had removed government funds from the bank, to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In the famous Charles River Bridge case of 1837, Taney's court would rule against state-sponsored monopoly in transportation and thereby reinforce the ethic of equality of opportunity and no special privileges. In the process of doing all of this, Jackson also helped to recreate a two-party system in the United States. He and his supporters claimed the Jeffersonian mantle, and they called themselves Democratic Republicans, or Democrats for short. They united around the issues of destruction of special privilege and a strict interpretation of the Constitution. Jackson's opponents would call themselves National Republicans, or Whigs, and they would favor continuation of government control or direction of economic growth, and thus a broad interpretation of the Constitution. Many at that time and still today view Jackson's laissez-faire economics as well as his political behavior as democratic. But in reality, his economic policies mark the triumph of those who favored a highly speculative economy with rapid growth and ensuing risks, over traditionalists who favored government supervision and more modest growth. And the results were catastrophic in the economic realm for many due to the destruction of the bank and the ensuing financial chaos and depression of 1837. Furthermore, as we'll see in a future lecture, the United States government never truly practiced a total hands-off laissez-faire policy with the economy, all the rhetoric to the contrary notwithstanding. What about the political realm? Here, the spoil system and other related political reforms wound up not destroying special privileges, but enhancing special privileges for some. Indeed, the takeover of the White House and the near riot on the day of Jackson's inauguration was the work not of the, quote, common people, but a horde of office seekers. Also, the expansion of rights for